When that robot voice comes in, you know it is time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to
ELC.
Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks in sneaks using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, maybe you're mowing the lawn. Maybe you're raking the leaves. Maybe you're doing the housework. Whatever the case, we're going to be in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be, and that is completely free thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. Those fine folks, those generous individuals, those heroes make this show possible by supporting the show, by finding value in it and giving value back. And in exchange, they get some extra value, including ad-free versions of the show, video versions of the show on demand, and a bunch of bonus content, including Feeling This, the show where Christian Spicer and Alex Solman talk about the feelings behind video games. They also got early access to a really fun conversation that Christian and I had about his new stance, his new take, his new approach to games and reviews. Lively conversation for 45 minutes out to patrons. Plus, if you come at us at a certain level, you get the Wednesday paid DLC program with Lana Bashinsky joining us to talk about the stuff the patrons are into, the patrons are on to. We got a prompt every single week. We chat it up. It's a lot of fun. It's a little goofy, a little sillier, a little looser than this show, but oh my goodness, is it fun. All of it available to patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, it's the show all about games. In their many forms, games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata. That's spelled with two N's and one T. And I'm joined, as always, by my friend, slash co-host, slash nemesis. The guy who's back with the mustache. Mustache man. Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Hello, Jeff. It's back. I mean, it's mostly here for Halloween.
A little clue as to the costume?
Yeah, you can like tape them on, but I always like, you know, if I'm able to. Well, so I've also been really
training. I
believe
you just concentrate for like 15 minutes and one appears. Mine take longer.
I have to work on it. I've been taking a lot of gun fu lessons also. I've killed a few people who killed my dog. Like I'm working toward, no, I'm just kidding. I'm not John Wicking it, but I would love just like, really? No. Call me my Halloween costume for the next month.
Well, yeah, I guess we're there, man. End of September. So are we got to already start prepping for Halloween? I think I'm going to be, I was kind of mentioning this before we started. I think I'm going to be a K-pop demon hunter character because that's what everybody in the fam's going to be, a K-pop demon hunter. I don't know which one I'm going to be. My daughter Zoe is, of course, going to be Zoe. But everybody else is still up in the air at this point, but we're
be the old man from the bathhouse.
Yeah, creepy old man.
Who are you? Get out of the bathhouse!
Very little prep on my part, yeah. So maybe that'll work. Hey, we have an awesome show for you today. We got lots of really interesting games to talk about. We have some cool news to dig into, a bunch of indie games that were shown, and lots of other cool stuff. And, ladies and gentlemen, we have a fantastic guest to do it with. You know, the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, I'm excited because DLC stands for Dissecting the Larger Context. Because from Post Games, the show about the how and why of video games, we have host and founder Chris Plant back with us. Hey, Chris, how are you?
I'm great. I really thought it was just going to be downloadable Chris. That seems so much easier, but I'll take the context. That's great.
I don't take the layups. You know, I shoot for the threes. I take the
threes. Sure, yeah.
Jeff has ruined podcast intros just like Steph Curry has ruined the NBA. He only shoots from half court.
Yeah, my shooting percentage is not great, but I'll take the threes anyway. Chris, I have to tell you, we were talking about this a little bit before we started, but my goodness, I am so impressed with Post Games. It really feels like, you know, what if NPR did a really high knowledge video game show? Really great production value, such depth of content. Kudos to Post Games. What a great accomplishment.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's exactly what I set out to do, but with like more conversation about, I guess, like pornography games and stuff that would never get on NPR. Do I say that NPR? You know, they're going for broke. They don't care at this point. You might as well swing for the fences.
They got nothing to lose over there. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. But yeah, I hope people check it out because I've been really enjoying it, and you know, it's so really good. Great. Yeah.
Thank you.
Strike it out on your own, taking a risk, doing something you really care about and you believe in. We applaud that here too. So very good.
Thank you. And I appreciate y'all giving me a platform like this to share it with more people. I mean, it's, you know how it is in this business. When you get to do something with people that you have admired for like decades, it feels like we're just like, wow, it's kind of like shocking. I was talking to a previous guest, Brendan Bigley, who obviously has done the show, and it feels like a little nice little milestone to get to do this.
Well, that's very kind.
We like, you know, we're like, oh, let's do it. So many of us, I'll include me in this. It's like, we should do our show. We should do our thing. What are we going to do? I don't know. Turn on a mic and talk. We'll do it once a week. That's a Herculean task. And Chris, you're like, what should I do? I don't know. I guess I'll do a show. I'll do a weekly show with edited segments, music, reporting, guests. Going to get it done every single, like, I am blown away by your production timeline, and it's like, it's, I mean, awesome. Jim Lee can't even get Hush 2 done on time, and it's like his big comic book opus.
Yeah, those are just,
I mean,
doodles.
That's actually what I've been doing on my side. I've been ghostwriting. I'm going to love this new Game of Thrones book I've been putting together. It's huge.
Awesome.
I'd believe it.
Well, let's jump in and start talking games the way we always do with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. That's also where you can send us comments or questions or anything you'd like us to know. We love hearing from you, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. But that is not the only way. You can also participate in our discussion with the wider community by heading over to our Discord, which is 5x5DLC on Discord. Really great folks hanging out there, talking all sorts of cool topics, including games. But Chris, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
So this one's really tricky because it's a story that I'm both really excited about and really like concerned about at the exact same time. And that is this 6-1 indie showcase, 40 games shown all at once, which on one hand, thrilled, 40 indie video games. That's amazing. And on the other hand, a rock at the very bottom of my tummy that's like, 40 amazing indie games. They all can't survive. Like, I've seen Battle Royale, the film, and I know how this goes, right? And in watching it, I just had a whole bunch of complex feelings while watching it. You know, a lot of excitement and a lot of enthusiasm, and I don't want to, like, throw that away. But also, like, we're in a really strange, strange time. A little bit of a monkey paw wish.
Yeah, the other thing that happened in the middle of this presentation, by the way, you're right, 40 games. But then, forgive me, I forget her name, but the woman who came on and talked about it also being part of a Steam, she's like, oh, and also there's an additional 150 games for you to check out there. And I was like, what? What was that exactly? 150 more games? I don't know how anybody in this space makes any money or makes a living, for that matter. But it is an abundance of riches for sure. Before we dig into the specifics of the games, do you want to talk a little bit more about that, Chris? I mean, is it concern for these developers, I guess?
Yeah, it's concern of expectations. I think, two things I felt while watching it. One is, on one hand, it's a really great marketing idea to pair similar games together. On the other hand, it actually had this weird effect where I was watching it. I was like, oh, and here are the games about depression. Oh, and here are the like very pretty, you know, gentle, cozy games.
Yeah.
And it in a weird way made what once felt really special, where you like played an indie game, like, I've never seen anything like this, start to feel like kind of rote, which it isn't, to be fair. Like, these are 2-minute little blurbs of games. it's not rote, but the way that it was presented kind of gave me that feeling. The other thing that I've been thinking a lot about is a long time ago, and by a long time ago, I mean when we were kids, if you wanted to start a band, you would do it. And the expectation would be like, hey, maybe we will play the biggest venue in town. Maybe. And we'll make like some money, but like that's it. And we're going to put a ton of work into it, but we're also going to, we know we need to have day jobs, and maybe we'll do like a tour of like the tri-state area. And then maybe
hey, be quiet,
because
now you're talking
that.
About all of my favorite bands, just so right? you know. They all started yeah. there. They all did the tri-state, then they blew up, then they
hey, I grew up around the Kansas City area during the emo scene, and like I could tell you all about the Anniversary and the Get Up Kids, Rise and Not Quite Fall. But
so
but
good.
But the expectations were understood, right? Yeah. And I think what is really tough with video game development right now on the indie level is I'm not sure the expectations are clear to the people who are making these things. So I think there are a lot of people who make these as a job, right? And back in the day, if you're like, what are you doing? You're going to quit all of your work and you're going to make an indie band and you're just going yeah. to bet that it's going to be the one that breaks out. That would seem really strange, where it doesn't quite seem strange right now. And I think that these things always correct themselves. But watching – it truly was watching this thing where I was like, oh, we are right in the middle of a course correction, where there are a lot of people who think that there's money to be made here. And like the very sad reality is only a very small number of these are going to like pay themselves off.
Yeah.
And that's hard.
You're not wrong, and it is hard not to think that way when you're sort of drinking from the fire hose in a presentation like this, where there's so much there. And even I, who really loves indie games and wants to champion these games, there's, you know, in a 40-game presentation, there's, I would say, two dozen where I'm just like, okay, next, you know, I'm not really even – I can tell that one's not for me. I can tell that one's not for me. You know, it's sad because a lot of these folks are putting in, as you say, a lot of time and energy and hope into them. Yeah. But you know, a lot of these also feel like passion projects or love letters to a lot of them feel quirky and different and unique, and I love that about them too. You know, you don't want to quash that. You don't want to, you know, trim at the edges of this creativity and say, hey, you know, don't put in the time and effort because you're not going to break even. But I do think that is the sad reality.
Yeah. Or put in the time and the effort again, like those bands, and just know what the end result is. Yeah. Definitely. I hope everybody is making these things. I just hope that they're like not mortgaging themselves on it, but that's not really my problem. We should definitely talk about how wonderful some of these games are. I will just add one small thing that happened right before we got on the show, which is I saw the developers of Consume Me, which it won the IGF, the grand prize, the IGF this year, right? Huge game. It won the indie prize. It comes out the same day as Hades 2. And you can tell that the energy is like, hey, is this going to be okay? Is this game going to sell? And how incredible are we, how incredible is it that we're at this point where the winner of the IGF, of the Independent Games Festival, is now going up against another, quote, indie and has to worry about sales? Like, that's just wild to me. We've come so far in a way.
Yeah.
But now it's like, oh, okay, we've caught the mailman. Now what?
It does feel that way. It also feels like we could further stratify the indie space, because it does feel like there's AAA inside indie, you know, and then there's,
for sure,
there's strata there. It's not that that's particularly necessary or useful, but it does feel like there are the haves and have nots, because, you know, comparing a Hades 2 to, you know, some of the stuff that we're seeing in this presentation, that really feels like, you know, a strange passion project. That's going to struggle to find an audience. Those are also disparate things. So I don't know. But let's dive into the games themselves, because as we said, there are 40 of them that they showed and across a whole wide variety of genres and playstyles and interesting ideas. And I wonder if you had any particular ones, Chris, that that leapt out to you as things maybe you didn't know about before and now you have your eye on?
It's like hard genuinely to pick just one or two. But the thing that I have known about and I just can't wait for is Perfect Tides Station to Station. Do you know about Perfect Tides?
No, I don't.
Oh my gosh, dude. Okay, so I'm glad I mentioned the emo era already before this. What if I told you you could get a LucasArts style point and click adventure set in the suburbs of a kid in the middle of the emo era? And Ooh. It is like all that same vibes, that weird thing where you're kind of hanging out with people who are older than you. You love where you live, but you also need to get out of there. And that game is available now. You can go play it. You should go play it. There is a sequel coming out called Station to Station that is about the main character, who is now 18, moving into the big city. I think it's New York. Hmm. And for me, again, just egotistically, this is my life. Like, I grew up in very rural Missouri, and then I went to college at NYU, and I was there during that music scene. The very first night I was at NYU, I went and saw the Fiery Furnaces. And the Shins. The next night I saw Wolf Parade and Modest Mouse. And it was just this, like, wow, this is my life. I'm here. I'm doing this. And then like after that, I'm like, oh, I have no money for the next 6 months. Cool. Great. But I love that. I mean, talking about, again, passion projects, truly, this is someone putting their heart and soul into the work. And I've been looking forward for it the second I finished the previous game. And I'm glad that I'll get a chance to play it in January.
Again, that's called Perfect Tide Station to Station. It's set to come out January 22nd, but there is a demo that is available now on Steam. And we should say all this stuff, you know, they were quick to reiterate, and we know it to be true, that wish listing indie games really does impact them positively. So if you're interested in stuff, you're listening and you're interested in stuff, it is a good idea to wish list. It doesn't cost anything, doesn't take anything, just a click, and it does actually help these indie developers. So Perfect Tides, Station to Station, top of your list. Maybe another one you thought looked cool.
Oh, you know, I'm all about the Little Gator game. You know that I saw that there's more Little Gator game coming. They're putting that game in the dark because that's the subtitle, In the Dark. If you haven't played Little Gator game, what you might have played a short hike. I feel like that game had a real moment.
Yeah, it did.
Little Gator game is kind of the evolution of that. What if it was like a little bit more high touch? If Short Hike is the SNES version, Little Gator game is the Nintendo 64 version, is how I would translate them. And it's just a delight. What's wild about this, I really want to hear what y'all are excited about, because I feel like I could just name things and you're like, I've never heard of it. And I'm like, yeah, I know. And then we'll look on the Steam reviews and it's like 40,000 people reviewed it. Yeah. What are y'all so hyped about?
Yeah, Christian, do you have any top hits from the 40 games of the Indie Showcase?
Well, I do, and I'll be talking about them later in another segment of our show as well. But
because a number of these have demos now, you can try them out.
I will talk about them later, and it legit is the three that probably jumped out at me the most during this presentation. One is a game called Lucid, which is Celeste.
The very first one they showed. Yeah.
Yep. Celeste meets Metroidvania, which very much has the Celeste aesthetic going for it, in addition to kind of the precision platforming, air dashing and stuff like that. I thought that looked awesome. Sheep Herds looked like cozy in the sense that there's not a stressful timer where you are you can select the various type of dog. And again, I'll talk about these more later. And you're kind of just wrangling sheep into the corral in a Unity esque looking game, like bright colors. You can kind of see like the blades of grass, you know, kind of blowing and as you move through. And then God's TV, which aesthetically maybe spoke to me the most of these. And then the last one I'll mention, Jeff, and I feel like I wonder if they were a little bummed that Acclaim had their showcase first. What was it? Pixel Washer, the pig.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. 2 weeks back to back, we got a pixel-based power washing games. I couldn't believe
this one. This one is Mold Washer, which I think for my money looked better is not the right word, but looked more interesting to me. Like the way you're like kind of, you'd clean this, at least in this trailer, you'd like clean the sink and then you'd pull, now the sink's, you can see it. So then you pull the drain and then you clean that. And then I kind of liked that. Power Wash Simulator had that too, where it's like multi-step cleaning, which yeah. for some reason is fun in a video game, but terrible in real life. Like at no point do I look at my shelf and go, sweet. After I dust all of those old iPods I've kept for some reason, I then get to dust the shelf under them. Multi-step cleaning. But I thought Mold Washer looked fun and kind of scratching that same itch, but very much seemed similar to Pixel Washer as well.
It's so funny how I made a big deal about that last week, and then here's another pixel-based power washing game. Very funny. But yeah, it looked cool. I think the one that leapt out to me the most that I'm immediately wishlisted is a game called Undermire, which they purport as having this Saturday morning cartoon aesthetic, which it absolutely does. It looks very cartoony and bright and colorful, but it is a first-person perspective game, and it looks like you've got a bunch of magic spells, but it kind of set in modern times, I think, because you have like lunchboxes and stuff. Man, it looks really cool. The art is just so different than anything else. You know, people have seen, what's that game? The Mickey Mouse, the sort of Steamboat Willie looking first person shooter, gun.
Oh yeah. What's that called?
Like Mouse PI or something like
something
that.
Something like that. Yeah. Anyway, so it think, you know, that kind of very animated look, but in a first person shooter 3D environment. And that's kind of what Undermire is doing, but much more colorful and vibrant. So I was taken by the look of that game. Another game, the look I would not expect myself to be drawn to is the last game they showed, which is called City of Dolorosa. And the developers introed it in a really kind of a way that was, I found a little off-putting. They were like doing a ritual sacrifice. And I know they were trying to be funny, but I was like, I'm not going to be into this game. And then they showed it and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It doesn't look like any other game I have ever seen. It has this sort of, they say it's all hand-drawn. Every single thing in it is literally drawn on paper and then digitized into the computer. And it has this very heavy ink look, almost like graffiti or tattooing that you might come across. But it is also a first person, or it looks to be a first person perspective. And I've just never seen a game look like that before. And I was very impressed with finding a kind of art direction that I've never encountered before. I don't know if I'll like the game, but I'm intrigued by it. Sorry, go ahead.
It just gave me, it's not exactly the same, but it gave me memories of like, what about a cleaned up version of, was it Street Fighter 4 that used like the ink? Those, it's not cel shaded, but it's like, how do you add definition to something that creates a different look? Like Street Fighter 4 didn't do anything necessarily revolutionary in what they were doing, but they added that like ink splatter and those ink outlines to the characters. And that, I think, made that game stand out in a really cool way. And I think it's fun to see people playing with that aesthetic or kind of how line art.
Yeah, but it was so exaggerated and almost like graffiti where the characters are really kind of grotesque. And, you know, obviously this is about a city of demons. So, it's kind of got this very extreme, very adult look to it. But they showed the art and then they showed, you know, kind of interacting with a NPC shop seller and it's all 2D and it looks like, oh, that looks cool. But then they showed it in the 3D engine and I was like, whoa, that is wild. Another one I thought was neat was Recur, which has, you know, time bending, rewind time mechanics that we've seen quite frequently in platforming games, which is what this looks like. But it looked really beautiful. It kind of had it reminded me of like Wallace and Gromit or something like that, the look of Recur. But I always enjoy, you know, rewinding time and solving puzzles with stuff like that. And then Dice-A-Lot. I am a sucker for dice games.
That's the one that I felt like was your game, other than I forget how many. I think Chop Chop was the first one they showed of like an actual tabletop board game.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, they did a pseudo tabletop game and an actual tabletop. Like Jeff's eating this presentation up.
For sure. I was.
Do y'all think that this is the beginning or the end of the PlayStation 1 Sega Saturn aesthetic boom?
My hope is that it's the end. I do not care for it, but
yeah,
it feels to me like it's ramping up, not down. But what is your take?
Yeah, I kind of thought we were near the end, and I was like, oh no, that was just a brief lull. And now that people have seen it with, you know, a few games, we're about to get like the real boom. That, you know, the first 20 were the, you know, they inspired what's now going to be a moment. Because, yeah, between this and just some other stuff I've been playing, we were recording the Besties bonus for our Patreon this week. And while I was recording that with Russ Freshick, who I worked with at Polygon, we realized all three of the games that we had brought had that aesthetic.
Interesting.
It was like, okay, yeah, something's happening.
I am not a fan. I mean, it sounds like you are, and certainly lived through that time, played all those games, but I don't have a nostalgia for that look the way that I have nostalgia for pixel art. Look, it feels like that was literally just a hindrance of the technology. And if any of those developers could have had more sophisticated 3D, they would have, you know?
And I'm finding playing more of these is I actually appreciate the look more now than I did then. But I have no lost love for that era of gameplay.
Yeah.
And for all it's totally, I'm like, yeah, fine. Make it look like PlayStation 1. Cool. Please don't let it feel like a PlayStation 1 game. I don't think people remember just how excruciating 99% of these things were to play. Same with the Nintendo 64. This was not an area of regular had fun. It was more of like wrestling with a machine.
Right. We used to have to talk endlessly about the camera and how much.
Yes.
Is the camera a problem in this one? Because it usually is a problem.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Christian, open to other games that stood out to you, but I love seeing, you know, we kind of talked about this at the top with these kind of you know, passion projects. I love seeing the weird, and it seemed like there was quite a lot of the weird here. I'm thinking of maybe weird as a, I don't mean it as a pejorative. I mean it as a, you know, a compliment, unusual or, you know, sort of not blazing a new trail, maybe is a more positive way to say it. A game like A Heavy Morning, which looks to be literally just about trying to get out of bed, you know, a game all about trying to get out of bed. Just what an interesting idea to pursue. Like, let's make an entire game about how difficult it is to get out of bed sometimes. There's that pigeon love story game, which is literally just about a pigeon trying to find their beloved in the sea of pigeons.
One, I think it's very cool how they've rendered the cities to scale where that game takes place, or the cities that you can play that game in, I guess, or visit. You know what I'm trying to say. But I also found it very interesting that it was kind of pitched as a relaxing game, and relaxing and struggle to find your soulmate are like opposite ends of the you know spectrum for me. It's like, you know, just find your soulmate in an accurate, true to scale New York full of as many virtual pigeons are is really, and I'm like, this is a Herculean task.
Yeah,
this poor little pigeon. It's very stressful. Yeah.
Sounds like you're gonna have to struggle to get out of bed to play this one.
Yeah.
There's also
the reason
game,
why I married my high school sweetheart. You know, I found her. I'm done searching.
Ease of use. Yeah.
Yeah.
that game Oku, which it looks to be a game about writing poetry. Which hey, that's cool. But it's also, you know, it's a 2D kind of walk around, set in Japan, but then you write poetry with nouns and verbs that you acquire.
Yeah.
You know, I love the indie space for stuff like this, where
did you spot, Children of Saturn?
Yes.
So again, talk about games that are of that aesthetic that we just talked about. Yeah. When I saw it, I was like, oh, it's a game about kids who played the Saturn. It is in fact not that. No. It looks like a game set in the 90s. It is set very much in modern times and about a group of teenagers who have been cursed to live during the climate apocalypse.
Yeah.
But looks like the energy of like a Nine Inch Nails music video or those very early PlayStation ads.
Yeah.
Yes. It looks sick. I've never seen a trailer for a game where I'm like, wow, I'm going to feel so bad playing this and I can't wait. Like, I am hyped, bro.
The other one that I should have said at the beginning of the show, we're recording a little early this week. It's my wedding anniversary this weekend, so I'm going out of town. So we're recording a little early. I wanted to have some time with some of these demos, and I haven't. So maybe I'll talk about it next week. But one of the ones that has a demo that I wanted to try out that looks weird and I kind of can't even wrap my head around it, but I love the title, is Scrabdackle. Do you guys see Scrabdackle? They called it a combination of a Zelda-like, a Souls-like, and a weird indie thing, which I love. That's their descriptors. So I don't know. They said that Act One is going to launch soon. And Act One is 15 hours, has 90 minutes of original music, 65,000 words, and 122 notebook entries to make.
That's a video game. That's just a video game. You can just release a video game. That's cool.
That's cool. Anyway, tons of stuff here. Again, 40 games. I'm sure we're giving short shrift to a whole bunch of them. Oh, On Any Journey looked really cool because it literally is different aesthetics all in the same game. It's like, it's got 3D hand-painted art, pixel art. It's like every level looks slightly different, at least what they showed. So lots of cool stuff here.
You know what? I've changed my mind. All of these games are going to be successes. They don't need my worry. Yeah, well, it's going to work out. It's going to be okay.
Again, folks, wish list. It does help the developers. All right. We're going to take a quick break for a sponsor. We got more Stories of the Week coming up right after this. All right, Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
There's a new report or a new article, scientific finding, titled Why Access Inversion, Optimizing Interactions Between Users, Interfaces, and Visual Displays in 3D Environments by Drs. Jennifer Corbett and Dr. Jap Manuk. And this was started kind of COVID time, kind of this research into this, and the journal article has kind of just come out, and it's about why people invert the y-axis.
Oh, why would you be interested in this study, Christian? That's weird.
It's fascinating. So I am a y-axis inverter.
You're a militant y-axis inverter. You're a oppressive, angry y-axis inverter.
Wow. I can't play the game otherwise. So yeah, mm-hmm. and now I have scientific proof it's because my brain don't work like that. So this study that these two doctors did, one is now at MIT, the other is at Northeastern University, started with a survey kind of asking people how they play. And they got a lot of stuff that we've talked about on this show, Jeff, of like, oh, I grew up GoldenEye, or I grew up in the era of the only one analog stick. And back in that day, things were default inverted. And then they talked to more younger players or more modern gamers who are like, no, I came up in the era of the default was not inverted. So that's how I play. And so they assumed they'd see some correlation or some stronger correlation between that. Like that kind of decides it. But what they found out while they did, they wanted to look for important cognitive components to the inversion question that could be measured only through behavior responses. So they created a questionnaire. And then they had players or people doing this mentally rotate random shapes and take on the perspective of an avatar object in a picture to determine which way something was tilted and differently tilted backgrounds to overcome the typical what's called Simon effect, where it's harder to respond when a target is on the opposite of the same side of the screen as the response button.
No, opposite versus the same side.
Yes, thank you. Sorry.
So if the button is on the left, but the prompt is on the right, it's harder for you to match those things rather than if the prompt is on the left and the button is on the left. So if it syncs up, your brain goes, oh yeah, I pushed the left one because it was on the left-hand side of the screen. But when it's when they invert it, your brain goes, ah, that's harder. And you have to think longer and it's harder to be as quick with your response.
And right. And so they're having people also, you know, mentally rotate those shapes in order to achieve these tasks. And so what they found is that the assumptions being made around the controller preferences, we talked about, oh, I grew up on N64. I came up later in the Halo era. Those were wrong. That didn't really have anything to do with why controllers were inverted or not. The most predictive measure was how quickly gamers could rotate things and overcome the Simon effect. The faster they were, the less likely they were to invert. People who said they sometimes invert were by far the slowest on the task. So they found that people that always invert were slower but more accurate, and people that don't invert are faster but slightly less accurate. And then ultimately said you should try the other because there is some connection, some correlation to how your brain is wired to whether or not you are, air quote, better with inverted controls or not. So just because you grew up in the N64 era and that's how you've learned to play doesn't mean that is the, quote, best way, air quote, I should say, best way for you to play, and vice versa. Just because you learned one way doesn't mean that that's going to be the way that you're most successful at it. And what I think is even more fascinating about this study is how they broadened the application to something outside our little hobby of video games, to like controlling robots, virtual surgery. Like you make these important controls for these things, and they have now started on some basis of understanding what the default control should be for particular users. This blew my mind, like me failing in the Simon effect did, you know? I think it's fascinating that there's something in my little dumb brain that's like, yeah, that's how I manipulate space. And it's not just because I was playing Dreamcast era 3D games.
It's not because you grew up as a fighter pilot.
Yeah. Right. Because they don't need me anymore. I'm a bygone era.
Yeah. I feel like this is fascinating that you're sort of born that way. But it also makes sense to me because hearing, especially you, talking to you enough, Christian, hearing you talk about this, it doesn't feel like something that is just habitual. It feels like something that is a difficult way. Having it non-inverted is literally an impediment in your brain somehow, that how you conceptualize looking up or looking down is just a different, there's just a different concept in your head about what that means. You think about it as pushing forward to look down, right?
A stick on the back of my head. Think of like a camera tripod, yeah. Right? There's like a stick.
But I don't think that comes from just, being ingrained in it. I feel like that does seem to be a natural proclivity that people like that have. Chris, are you an inverter or non-inverter?
So, very strange. I was an inverter all the way up until my kid turned like 2 or 3.
Oh, wow.
And then I decided intentionally to switch because if I was going to play games with my kid and I'm passing the controller back and forth, and by that time he had very quickly, you know, learned the traditional way. And what is weird about this is I was like the biggest invert-wise snob. I was, you know, like, you have to do it. Like, this is the way the real gamers do it. But what's strange is, I don't know when, but sometime in like the last 10 years, it started to not feel right. Like I would find that I was like not looking, you know, just in the tiniest ways, the wrong direction when I played a shooter. Yeah. And it didn't feel as natural to me. And then when I switched, it has felt so much better. But this isn't a thing like, you know, when this is non-scientific, people be like, well, that just shows you, you know, inversion is the worst. No, because when I was younger, it truly did feel better. I tried many different points in my life to switch and couldn't because it truly felt wrong. So yeah, the part where it says like, hey, you might actually want to try going back and forth because maybe you are using the wrong version, which I think applies actually to a lot of people who don't invert right now, that like they should give it a shot, is really, really interesting to me. And then, yeah, for all of us old heads that like, we should revisit it now and then and see if it's like the best way to play. All of that said, though, like it only really matters in like really hardcore twitchy games.
That's true. Well, but if it feels, you know, it feels better. It could be, for Christian, if it, he can't even play a game that doesn't offer inverting. He's just like, that doesn't feel right. I can't do it.
Very bad.
Oh yeah, that's how it was at first. Where like even a third person game, there was a Beyond Good and Evil re-release where it like infamously didn't have inverted as an option, despite it being a re-release, and I was like, oh, it's cool. So now I just know that I don't have to play this game ever. And the good thing is, I still have plenty of time to play it before the sequel comes out. I think
that's
I've got
true.
It
yeah,
like 20
you,
or 30
you got
years.
Got a nice cushion. Did you always just assume that you did it that way because that's the way you started playing games? Or did you, what did you attribute it to?
It is comical how often this is the reason for people our age. I played Descent. A PC. It
but
is
Descent
like that
is,
game.
Descent is using a spaceship, like fighter pilot.
100%
metaphor.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But like Descent, it did it to a whole generation of us.
Do you gentlemen? I forget when this started. Maybe it was. Oh, I was gonna say 5 years ago. Longer than that. Maybe 7 years ago. On Apple devices with the touchpad, there's like natural scrolling on the. Versus what it used to be. Like one is like, oh, well now instead of I'm pulling the page down, I'm using the marker. Like there's two different ways you can have your scroll, and whatever the updated one that they did, I was like, no, that's not how my brain interacts with a page at all. And then so I could get on somebody else's computer and you just quickly, you know, gesture control, like two finger to scroll a page, and like the page starts going up when I swipe one. And I'm like, that is. And I just find it fascinating. Yeah. They talk about in this article, which was in The Guardian, kind of reporting the story, that, you know, they liken it to forever ago with people that were left-handed. Like you can learn to write with your right hand, and then you'll have lifelong handwriting issues. It will be uncomfortable, and it will never be as natural if you are allowed to learn with your left hand. And I think what, you know, what they seem to be discovering here is there's more to it than just handedness, and there are other things I think where we might have a natural inclination to.
I didn't have a chance to read the full report. Did they end up kind of similar to left-handed people find that people use inverted controls are also the devil?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's my position. As a left-handed person,
we are gross trolls, and that's why Jeff and I get along. He's a troll under the bridge, and I'm a troll in the cave. But we're both trolls, so it works.
The closest thing, experience that I've had to this, because as a left-handed person, my entire life has been pain and torment. You know, I still use a mouse with my left hand. All of my left-handed friends, literally all of my left-handed gamer friends, taught themselves how to use a mouse with their right hand. And oh, how I wish I had done that, because it has given me no end of, you know, WASD for me is terrible. I have to do PL apostrophe, you know, it's terrible. But when we all, because we're, you know, olds, when we all started playing first-person shooters with a controller and there was only a single analog stick, what happened was they made the face buttons up, down, left, and right. You would move with the face buttons and rotate with the. So it was backwards.
Precision was given to the analog. It was southpaw. What is called southpaw now?
That's right. And so for me, that was like, this is great. This is completely natural. I played Quake on Dreamcast. It was great, great. And then all of a sudden, Halo comes out and is like, nope, we're flopping it. We're flip flopping it. And you move now with your left stick, and you look around with your right stick. And I was completely flummoxed. And I remember a game came out on, I think it was the first Xbox or maybe 360. No, it must have been the first Xbox, called Metal Arms. And it's a game I loved, but it didn't offer southpaw flip-flop. It made you do it that way. And I couldn't play it. I was like, I love this game so much and I can't play it, you know, effectively. And I literally wrote the developers and like, sorry, we don't have any, you know, intent to update this with I was so mad. And I had to teach myself how to use a controller, and now I can't go back. So, you know, there is something to be said for sort of forcing yourself to try the other way, I guess.
And I think this article in the study says you can learn it, but it might not be your best, which I think is, you know, also interesting and fascinating. I don't know. I thought it was cool as a lifelong inverter, as a person who famously had a chance to play Breath of the Wild before anybody else. And I had to say, I cannot play it, dear sir.
I will say very quickly, the weird thing on that is they're like, oh, maybe if you practiced in the inverted, if you use normal, like that'll make you stronger because you'll get the power of like your brain working in different ways. Let me just say, as someone who went through that process, that's just not going to work. The like 6 months in which you are between states is the most like nauseating 6 months while you're playing a game because nothing feels right. It's just left is right, up is down. It's terrible. The second you make the choice and then commit to the bit, because doing both is mayhem. That it's is like, mayhem.
To me, it's like saying work on your fastball by throwing with the other hand. It's like, that's not going to make my fastball faster. I'm just going to feel like an idiot throwing with my dumb hand. You know, I don't know.
Nothing says relaxing by playing video games by suffering through self-taught mental reshaping. You know, like, oh, I got 30 minutes to unwind. Let me suffer through switching my inversion.
All right. Well, we don't have to spend a lot of time on my my story of the week because it's I don't know. I think it's cool. We got a trailer for a new Splinter Cell TV show. Not a game. Still no new Splinter Cell game, but the official trailer for Netflix's new Splinter Cell animated series entitled Splinter Cell Death Watch dropped this week. It is going to star Liev Schreiber as the titular Splinter Cell. No, as Sam Fisher, of course. You know, that's not Michael Ironside, right? And he's not doing a Michael Ironside impression, but I think he's a pretty darn good actor, Liev Schreiber. And this is a grizzled, gray-haired, bearded Sam Fisher. This is older Sam Fisher who's been through it. And the trailer looks to have looks like the series is going to have a bunch of, cool spy stuff and intrigue. And I'm not particularly tied into the lore of the Splinter Cell franchise, but folks are saying that it actually does acknowledge the Chaos Theory games. It has his daughter who has grown up in it. Chris, did you get a chance to see this trailer?
I actually haven't watched the trailer. I read the story. This is the most like boring version of it. I read the article and didn't watch the pictures move.
should pivot to video.
You're right. Oh, that's huge. I am very curious about it just because of the Liev Schreiber casting, because for a certain set of dorks who both really love games and fantasy football, they will know Liev Schreiber as the voice of Hard Knocks, the preseason football documentary that airs each year.
Yes,
and
he's great.
When I can't see his face, if I just hear it, it's always Hard Knocks. So this just feels like the guy's like, oh, and they're going to have to sign a new punter because this one is getting married and doesn't want to play football anymore. And also, he's going to shoot and kill an assassin. It looks, I mean, Seems cool. I like literally haven't read it right now. It seems fine. The writer is one of the writers off John Wick.
Yeah.
So like, sure.
Derek Kolstad, right?
Yeah.
Is Ubisoft like just a media company now? Is that where they get their money?
Sure seems that way. Yeah. Sure seems that way. If they have any money at all. Christian, I believe you're probably the biggest Splinter Cell fan I know. Did you get jazzed seeing this?
I hope it's well done. I like the game Splinter Cell. I don't think that my favorite games need adaptations in other mediums. You know, I enjoyed Splinter Cell for the gameplay and less so for the story. I don't think I could. I've played all of them. I don't think I could tell you the Chaos Theory's twist versus the first one's twist versus Double Agent. Was that one of them? I don't even know all the names of all of them. But I thought the gameplay was really compelling. So I hope this is good. I like Derek's writing. What's his comic out right now? Death Planet. And I think having him write action that doesn't need to be constrained by how can we hide padding on this wall as we throw someone into it. You know, animated, I think, could suit his action really well. Kirby Howell Baptiste, whom I love, is one of the voices in this as well. So it seems like it's got a really good cast and crew attached to it. And the Castlevania by different crew. But, you know, Netflix has history of doing good animated video game shows. And if anything can bring Splinter Cell back as a video game, you know, I will root for it. So hopefully
that's my biggest takeaway.
This does it.
It's surprising to me that this isn't paired with, I mean, maybe this is the impetus to maybe, you know, if this is a success that it'll, you know, spur a video game. But it feels like if you were going to do this, we haven't heard from this franchise in a minute. You know, a lot of young people who aren't, you know, in love with this franchise. So that's surprising to me that they would do this in lieu of a video game or in the absence of a video game. I don't know. Anyway,
Clint Hawking doing? Is he making another Splinter Cell?
I don't know.
Is it that or Assassin's Creed? It's got to be one, right?
You'd think.
Oh, apparently, never mind. I answered my own question to Google. He is making an Assassin's Creed, so I guess it's not a Splinter Cell. I'm sorry.
Six of those being made, so maybe he's on one of those.
Yeah, that's true. And maybe they just start combining them. That's the ticket. That'll save them.
October 14th is when Splinter Cell Death Watch will hit Netflix streaming. All right, let's get into the games that we have been playing. But first, we'll take another quick break for a sponsor. We'll be back after these messages. All right, let's dive into our playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on the playlist. Chris Plant, what have you been playing this week?
Thank you for asking. I've been playing Eclipsium. Have you heard about this one?
I haven't.
Okay, so first, some table setting. And I talked about this a little bit on Besties, Resties, wherever it is I do other things. But have you been paying attention to Critical Reflex?
No, I don't even know what it is.
I feel like I'm at like the start of something here. Critical Reflex, they've been around. They've been publishing games for a while. They publish stuff that you definitely have heard of. They publish Buckshot Roulette. They published Mouthwashing, Lunacid, Arctic Eggs, like games, right? Like games. And then in the past 2 weeks, they have published three games that all look like they could be like breakout hits come the end of the year. They published this weird kind of papers, please comedy game called Trollio. They published this horror kind of like single player Among Us called No, I'm Not a Human, which you should definitely check out, even though that's not the one I'm talking about here. And then they published what I can only call a return to the walking simulator with Eclipsium. And I did not know how much I missed the walking simulator until I started playing this game. I will regret to inform you, it is the PlayStation 1 aesthetic.
Yeah, very much so. Like hard lean into that aesthetic.
Hard lean into it. Yeah. In fact, it's... Okay, so it's a first person. You're walking around a 3D environment. Your hands are just 2D photos, Mortal Kombat style, early Mortal Kombat that have been like sprayed on, like you're playing Hexen or something. But then not only does it look like a PlayStation 1 game, it runs at such a low pixel like density of resolution that it looks kind of like in the Apple II era or the NES, where they would scan a movie or an image in and try to like make it look okay on a screen that has a resolution of like a toothpick.
Totally.
And yet it is gorgeous, because if you're going to be in a horror walking simulator and you're going to be walking into like hell and back, when your resolution is that low, you can't really tell what anything is unless you get within like a foot of it. So it creates this weird cycle where you're like, oh, what's that? I wonder what that is. I'm going to get closer. I'm going to go, oh, I shouldn't have gotten closer. I should be walking the other direction. It's so cool to see a visual trick that actually serves the game. Yeah. Because, and I'm not trying to throw so many other indie games on the bus, it's cool to have great visual ideas in general. Art is really important. But there are plenty of games where it doesn't necessarily serve the game, right? And this is a game where every visual decision seems to make the gaming experience richer, down to the point that you can up the resolution in the settings. And it's like, please don't. There are like multiple warnings. They're like, this is not the intended experience.
Wow.
So yeah, I've been really, really enjoying it. I think it's going to get a lot of mixed reviews because it is very, very traditional in the walking sim thing of like, go from point A to point B. And the way it looks is a choice. But it's
yeah, it
one of
like
those games
that
like
headache every yes. every screenshot I'm looking out of this is like, oh, that it looks headache inducing.
Yes. I love like when I love whenever I like look at like Yelp reviews for something and it's like 3.5 and then you look at it and it's all ones and fives and
yeah,
I'm like, that's
yeah.
my shit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like tell me more. And this is one of those. Like it is an extreme one or a five. And for me it's a total five.
I love the big swing on the visuals because it is, I mean, it's like when you unlocked a video in Myst, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're like, you really should just not put a video in this game. Yeah. Like, no, we'll make it work. People
we got
will
it.
Have
yeah.
a general idea of what those blobs are.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That is Eclipsium. And it is on Chris's playlist. This is looks like it's like $12 on Steam right now.
Yeah.
It's low barrier to entry. Very, very interesting looking game for sure. Christian Spicer, you got some indie games on your playlist as well, right?
I do. Before I start and get into the 6-1 indies that had their demos come out, I want to start with another game that was called out to us on, was it last week's show? Time is my walking simulator.
It was Lucy James told us to play it.
Yeah, Lucy mentioned it. And then we got an email from a dear friend who said like, hey, Lucy mentioned this. You guys should check it out. So I did. The game is called Dead as Disco. It's by Brainjar Games CEO Will Cook. And the pitch is it promises to blend John Wick's kinetic action with music-fused choreography of Baby Driver. Yes, please. What a succinct pitch for games that Christian will be interested in. Lucy and our friend who emailed us both kind of mentioned the rhythm game aspect of it. And that had me thinking a little more Hi-Fi Rush than what I think Dead as Disco ends up being based on this demo. So it is Arkham Combat. And a music and neon filled world. Like the graphics, it's not, you know, God of War Ragnarok. It's not pushing the envelope. It's not even Arkham Knight level of like graphic fidelity, but it uses an art choice to its strength of kind of being this lower polygon or not realism, not chasing realism. It's like, you know, Hotline Miami, but third person action game, those kinds of neon soaked vibes and neon light trails behind your fists and stuff like that. And funky costumes that the characters are wearing. So it's not trying to be photorealistic. And I think it really works because of that. And so it is Arkham Combat, press Y to block. Some characters will telegraph that you can't block. So you got to dodge out of that. And then you're chaining your melee combat together. And you get in this, you know, symphony of destruction as you're surrounded by enemies, blocking one, hitting the other, all while this great music is pulsing in the background and being reflected in the environment around you. But what I think makes it different than Hi-Fi Rush is that your attacks, at least for me at this demo, and I did outscore our friend in the leaderboards after playing it. No big deal. And I've already texted him and let him know, so he's already aware. But the attacks aren't timed to the beat. Like Hi-Fi Rush, you know, you could brute force your way through it, but like I think it did less damage or whatever it was. In Dead as Disco, you're basically just doing Arkham Combat as you would, but I think you find yourself leaning into the beat because those games are already kind of musical. And so you have this score, you have these songs going, and the enemies are kind of reacting to it. It kind of makes you find a flow state that maybe you otherwise wouldn't as naturally. So I really like how those two come together as kind of peanut butter and jelly or peanut butter and chocolate or peanut butter I put on anything. It just makes it better having this musical element to it, to these fights. Really, really cool. The demo is one level, and then there's a kind of an unlimited like challenge room style thing where you can just kind of take on endless mobs. And one of the parts in the demo that I really love about it is you're doing this fight in a subway station down on the tracks, and you got to get out of the way as train cars come by on each side as you're battling these groups of enemies. And then it transitions to you being in a subway car from like a 2D or brawler style perspective. So the rest of the game, or the rest of the demo, is more the traditional Arkham perspective, 3D third person action game. But then it takes you to this 2D side scrolling or Ninja Turtle style perspective in the subway car, which, as a fan of brawlers, every brawler had the subway level. Where you're going, you know, like the infinite, the 100 car subway train, apparently. Yeah. You're just fighting your way through it, and enemies keep getting on even though the train never stops. So I loved that kind of homage to that. And I loved how well the Arkham combat still fit in a pretty limited, you know, up-down screen space where you're still able to use the block, the parry, the attack. It kind of reminded me of what Arkham Blackgate did on the Vita and 3DS back in the day. So, Dead as Disco, Brain Jar Games. I don't think there is a release date. No, just coming soon. So no release date for it yet, but very slick. Very, very well done. I am stoked for the, I mean, it is.
It lived up to the recommendation.
Yeah.
I apologize if you talked about it on the show already, but did you play Stick It to the Stick Man?
I did not either.
Okay. So this is my gift to you. You know, there's like a gajillion of those like Stick Man games on Steam where it's like, oh, you're a Stick Man and you kick people's ass. This is one of those, but it's published by Devolver, which we just mentioned earlier with Critical Reflex, which right away says it's meeting a certain threshold of quality, right? They partner with great people. Has like 3,000 overwhelmingly positive reviews and early access, but it is a Stickman combat game, and the first level is you going up a skyscraper, like the raid, and then another one is like kind of old boy going through a hallway and different phases. And the way the combat works is you collect cards, I guess, that play in order. So you'll get like roundhouse kick card, you'll get a knife card, you'll get bash with a hammer card, and then when you hit attack, it just cycles over and over and over again.
Interesting.
And you can upgrade those cards, so you end up doing this balletic combat because you're doing all these incredible moves, but you don't have to learn how to perform them because
cool.
You just play them in the cycle over and over and over again. It is really promising, like very, very, very promising.
This looks awesome.
Still early, but I definitely recommend it for as someone who likes brawlers. I am in that same boat. Good ones, really, really good ones, don't come around as often as you'd like. And this has kind of scratched that itch in a new way for me.
And it's early access, but it's also $4 right now on
Steam.
So
it's ridiculous.
There's a demo, and you know, you talk about it like a stick. You know, it's a Stickman game, yes, but I think the animation is really well done. It's not as simplistic as the form of the characters all are. It looks really sophisticated. Almost there's a lot of kind of effects that happen when you do your attacks. I'm just looking at it here. It looks, this looks awesome.
It has
actually
kind of like South Park Newgrounds humor, but updated in a way that doesn't make you like, like groan. It's just solid top to bottom.
$4. It's in my cart. That's a no brainer. That's
Hell
an impulse.
Yeah.
Buy.
I'd love to spend other people's money.
Very cool.
The
title is Stick It to the Stick Man. But the one Christian was talking about was Dead as Disco.
Yes. The next one I want to talk about was on the 6-1 Indie Showcase. It started the show with it. It immediately jumped out at me. I texted my Celeste friends, chat group about it. It's called Lucid. Lucid by Matt Black Studio from Eric Manahan. It was first launched on Kickstarter. And it also features music by David Wise of Donkey Kong Country, Star Fox Adventures, and many other games. And, when this starts and you start hearing the tunes, they are delicious. The pitch is, What if Celeste met a Metroidvania? And there is so much of the Celeste DNA in the visual aesthetic and the dash mechanic and the stay in the air as you navigate this, you know, 2D page that you need to traverse.
They use the term Celestoidvania, which I instantly love. Instantly love Celestoidvania. That's amazing.
I don't know. I feel like I just found like a boil growing on my spine. I have a Celestoid in my vein.
I chose to call it What If Celeste Met a Metroidvania. That was intentional. Yeah,
I've never met a portmanteau I didn't like, and this is a Portman 3. I'm sorry. That was bad.
Right, add more to it. the game is beautiful. It's got that pixel art, again, kind of a neon synthwave style aesthetic to it, or a look. And what I think is really interesting about the game is that it has a dash mechanic. Very early on in this demo, you have a dash mechanic, but the dash is only on the ground. Celeste famously has your air dash, and you can, you know, you gain a few more pops of it as the game progresses, but that's kind of how you're flying around. And then you're finding these charms that let you recharge your dash, so you can dash again and do whatever. In Lucid, you have a dash on the ground that you can use to jump higher. So you got to, it's kind of like you got to get a little speed, and then your character can jump higher, and then you get a double jump and stuff like that. But then it also has combat abilities, which is something Celeste does not mess with at all. Celeste, you're running away from yourself at certain points and you're avoiding enemies, so to speak, but you're not taking them on. In Lucid, one of the first abilities you get is basically a sword strike that then also gives you an air dash. So you have the ground dash that is used to higher jump, then you have jump, double jump, and then a different button, I think it's Y on the Xbox controller, gives you this sword strike that then gives you a little bit of an air dash. So you get into this rhythm of like, okay, this is going to be a high jump. I need to ground dash to get the high jump. Then I wall jump. Then I use my sword to get an air dash. And then it uses combat mechanics to reset your ability to, there's a name for what they call like star abilities. I forget the name. I apologize. But like to refill your double jump meter or your dash meter. And that's by striking breakable walls or enemies. So it becomes, you know, more complicated in terms of total buttons you need to press than Celeste. But when it really works, it's really, really fun because you're needing to balance multiple things in order to do the simple traversal and then also killing a few enemies along the way. I think the full game, I think, will go one of two ways for me. One, this will be a beautiful evolution of the Celeste formula, or it'll get too bogged down in combat and overcomplicate itself. You know, and I'm not sure yet, based on the demo. Chris, you're nodding. Are you feeling it?
Yeah, I'm definitely feeling it. I agree with that problem. I think that's the challenge, and what makes Celeste timeless is it knows when to stop. Mm-hmm. Maddie Thorson, I think, is one of the great living game designers. I think internalized the Nintendo kind of rule book better than almost any other person who hasn't worked at Nintendo. I think this is cool. I am super excited about it. But yes, you're 100% right. The second you start adding and adding and adding, it can become overwhelming. That said, like, comparing it is kind of silly. It's like, oh, I guess it's not one of like the 20 best games ever made. It's just a really great game, which it looks like it could be.
Go ahead. I think it could be one of the 20 best games. It's hard because it's doing the other part of the Portman 3, however you would say it, with three of them. It's doing the Metroidvania.
The boil, yes, yeah.
The boil part of it as well, where, you know, again, what makes the Celeste formula so timeless is that it's, you know where you need to get, you just got to get there. Here, there is a map that I didn't really dive into much in this demo, but like, oh, how interesting is that going to be if it's not just hunting strawberries, but actually getting upgraded abilities that then allow me to get through new parts of this world. And where I got to a boss battle toward the end of my playtime with the demo, and I died the first time, And while most deaths in level do the very Celeste or Super Meat Boy style thing of kind of restarting you closely back to where you were for that environmental challenge, this boss death spawned me back at a traditional kind of save shrine that was a little further from the boss than where I wanted to be. In the demo, I found that to be frustrating because I'd rather just take the boss on again. But I'm curious if in the full game, in the Metroidvania-ness of it, if that might actually have some really cool aha, you know, Silk Song level of like, oh, I should go another way first. And I'm not sure. So Lucid, I think, ticks all the right check marks for me right now. And I think it depends on how big it gets, if it becomes unwieldy or if it becomes my game of the year.
Wow, I love that.
It's got a lot of potential, I think. So again, that's Lucid. The next one I want to talk about is God's TV, which was also shown on the 6-1 Indie Showcase. Oh my goodness. Also, it looks like originally funded or funded on Kickstarter. Originally, it was set to be published by Starbreeze. And then Starbreeze had all of its stuff happen after, what, Payday 3, I think, is when
the
stuff hit the fan for them, like it does a lot of the industry right now, unfortunately. It's coming out of God's TV is coming out of Spain from Melbot Studios. And the person I want to shout out is Anna Kaddish. They are the character designer. Because my goodness, the character design in God's TV are incredible. It's like, what if Cartoon Network from the early aughts met 70s punk, and you know, in some way? It's just got this real cool infusion of like, yeah, we're these cutesy Cartoon Network style characters, but with like a middle finger attitude, you know, that I think is really cool.
There was a giant shoe in the trailer.
There's pizza. There's all these really fun, iconic looking characters that you look at and you're like, oh, I know what that is. You know, it seems like something you've grown up with, and they're unique characters. What I didn't know when I downloaded the demo and what I didn't know from the 6-1 Indie Showcase is that it is a rogue type. Not my jam.
Yeah.
Not my jam. But it makes sense for the type of game they're making. This is kind of an evolution of like, what if Smash TV, but today? Smash TV was meant to steal your quarters. So how do you take that quarter stealing, another run, high score chasing approach in the modern play it at home by yourself video game? The rogue type, Hades type style game makes a lot of sense. And so that's what they're leaning into here, is that you are, you know, on this reality TV show, you're a god and you're going to win the thing, get all the money. And so your upgrades come from sponsors, which is such a cool integration, you know, of the Hunger Games style approach to a rogue type game. It's like, oh, new sponsor drop. And then you go and you pick one of your Hades like upgrades. Oh, your dash now stuns people. Oh, you're immune after a hit, stuff like that. But thematically in the world works really, really well. This, would you be surprised, is also neon-soaked environments, and the background things are animating to the music as well. So it's not a rhythm game, but it really pulls you in with this great soundtrack and this frenetic pace as you're doing the Hades-style kind of isometric top-down twin-stick-style control. Really, really cool. There's going to be, you know, a hub world where you go back between runs, you die, and it's like, oh, you're not dead, honey, you're a god. You know, and I'm going to get you more sponsors and we're going to win this thing. And then you'll interact with the characters and it looks like it will do that, again, Hades style thing. It plays really smooth based on the demo. The sound is great. I think the character designs are great. The only kind of nit that I see with it for folks who love this style of game is the environments feel a little small. Whereas in games like Hades, it feels like you're kind of exploring the space, even though you get in these kill rooms where you're stuck. It feels like you're like navigating the River Six, right? Or like navigating these caverns. And here in God's TV, it feels like, oh, we've loaded you into the TV studio. You know, like this is where you'll be doing your fighting. But if you're into the rogue type of game, Hades really clicked with you. You're stoked for Hades 2. Definitely give God's TV a look. I mean, even the logo design, when you're playing, there's like a GTV logo in the top left corner of the screen that like where an MTV would be. It's like the whole package, everything works in this game in terms of selling the vibe they're going for. Really impressed with it.
Cool. Yeah, I was curious, even with the small size or the kind of scale, the camera seems even zoomed in compared to a lot of these games. If it's trying to capture the feel of the claustrophobia of a Smash TV, because that was part of the fun, right? Is like you were like locked in the box,
yeah,
and you know you're just getting swarmed. I don't know, but it definitely does have a different look than a lot of its peers.
Yeah, yeah, that is God's TV. And then the last one I want to talk about, I think my kids are going to go gaga for it. I need to wait for it to come to console so that we can play co-op. It is called Sheep Herds by Ultimate Disco and Leon France. I couldn't find information about people behind the studio, but I will keep looking. And it, as I mentioned, it has this made in Unity look, which I don't mean despairingly. It just kind of has that look of like flower. You know, like where every blade of grass you can kind of see, and they're kind of chonky, and the wind will kind of blow through it. Bright colors, and you are a dog, and you need to get sheep into their corral. That seems to be it. Sometimes the sheep like go through colorful flowers, and they change different colors. It's like, oh, you need to get the green sheep in, and then you need to get some red sheep. Like, oh, I got to wrangle them over to the red flower so they can change their color, and they can get in there. But it's just delightful, cozy style game that allows for co-op play, which I think will be a very fun level of annoyance because your dogs, you can bark to rush the sheep in, but they also, it says they have auras, so they will naturally herd the sheep as you go behind. So I could see you're playing with your, you know, your friend or your kid or whatever in the co-op situation, and you kind of accidentally crossing streams, and you're not able, you know, that fun type of chaos happens when you add more people to the mix when you're trying to do a task like this. But it reminded me of Sneaky Sasquatch, and even a little bit of Little Kitty Big City, in terms of it's not a challenge of dexterity, but there's stuff that you can unlock by doing challenges along the way that are meant to be, I think, pats on the back and not get good. You know, so you can upgrade things to unlock different types of dogs. Now you can play as a corgi. Now you can play as a corgi, a tourist corgi who has like a visor and a fanny pack on, and a pirate, you know, sheepdog or whatever. And all these fun, cutesy things that I think by replaying the levels, the way my kids replay activities in Sneaky Sasquatch or replay the entirety of Little Kitty Big City, I think will really speak to them. And I think it'll be a really nice couch co-op game. It's called Sheep Herds. I don't know. Let me see. Does this have a...
I think it has an exclamation point, Christian, and I don't hear it in your pronunciation.
Sorry. It is called Sheep Herds. Exclamation point!
Now I understand. Yeah. I was having trouble finding it, but yeah, now it makes a lot more sense.
You. We aim for clarity here, you know?
It's, appreciate it.
A 2025 release. No firm date. But again, the demo is out, at least as of this recording. It's delightful. Absolutely delightful.
Very cool. Yeah. Great look at some of the stuff that we were talking about earlier from the 6-1 Indie Showcase. We're going to take another quick break for a sponsor. I'll be back with my playlist right after this. All right, folks. This week, I played a game that, you know, this has been a crazy year. This has been an intense year. This is going to be a hard end of the year discussion, but it's making a real play for my top five. Seriously.
Wow.
Yeah, it is that great and that delightful. It's called Lego Voyagers. This is the latest game from Lightbrick Studios. Karsten Lund is the creative director. And I enjoyed this seems like a kind of a building on what Lightbrick Studios did with their previous game, Builder's Journey, Lego Builder's Journey, which is a game I liked, but ultimately found that it didn't quite click, if I may.
Hey.
It was good, but Builder's Journey was a Lego game where you put pieces in place to sort of allow a little Lego character, not a minifig, but like a little constructed kind of abstracted Lego character to get from one place to another. And it was cool in that it really felt like it was constructed out of Legos, a lot of digital Legos. And
The whole world was built out of Lego bricks, unlike, you know, the old Lego Batman game.
That's
where
right.
It was like,
or any of them, really. Most of the Lego games is, you know, there's Lego in the world, but the world is also not Lego. Yeah. But this one, you know, completely top to bottom Lego, which I loved. And but, it, you know, it just didn't quite get there. It was really beautiful and had elements that I thought were strong, but it didn't really work. This one, which is called Lego Voyager, I am going to just say flat out, is my favorite Lego video game ever. This is, and I would venture to say, the most Lego video game ever. Again, every single thing in the game is Lego, is created out of Lego. And that includes every little creature. There's butterflies flying around, and they're the little quarter circle plates, but they're animated to like flip and flop, so it looks like a butterfly. There's little creatures that you'll find, like the little hook bracket pieces just kind of move around, and it works. It looks like a little rat creature or some kind of strange thing with antennae. Brilliant use of Lego. And this was a design decision from the team. Carsten Lund says that you can, it is possible, and they made sure it was possible, to create every single thing you see in this game at home from your Lego collection. If you have the right pieces, you can make everything you see in this game, which is awesome. I love that constraint on the design of a Lego game, because it sells the thing I love about Lego, which is anything is possible. Buy into, you know, the construct of this world. It's like, you know, the Lego movie where even the water was built out of Lego. Now, there's water in this game that is water and not Lego water. But
I think this is true with the last game as well. Was like that was a point for them. Was
yes,
like,
yes.
See but it, build okay. it.
So the way that Lego Voyager differs from the previous game, Builder's Journey, is that you are in direct control of your character. And this, by the way, I should have said right at the top, is designed to be a co-op game in the same way that Split Fiction or It Takes Two are. This is a game you have to play with two people. It supports online co-op and local co-op. It also ships with a friend, it's not friend code, but friend pass, I guess they call
friend
it.
Friend DA, like you can only tell your friends about it.
Yeah, yeah. it's a friend benefit, they call it friends with benefit or something, I don't know what they call it.
No, we're playing the game, you need to come over so we can make out. I don't make the rules.
It's Lego
it's
game.
It's how it works.
Lego game. Oh yeah, making out is what I'm here for.
No, I think it's called friend pass, where if I buy the game, I can send you a version
Split
of it.
Split Fiction and stuff.
We can play together without you having Love to also it. Purchase the game. That is not how I'm playing it. I've been playing it side by side, sitting in front of my computer with my son. And we have been having
making out
the best time. Christian.
I'm radio here.
Not cool. Not cool. The thing about this game, if you've played It Takes Two or Split Fiction, you know how intense and twitchy and high velocity those games are. This is like, what if that same idea, but cozy? It's the cozy version of that kind of co-op experience where nothing's going to kill you. Nothing's attacking you. Nothing's rushing you. It's
so you don't step on any of the pieces at night?
Nope. Can't.
Wow.
You are, it is all about traversal and puzzle solving. And the puzzles do get pretty tricky and pretty clever, but man, you feel like a genius when you solve them. And all of the puzzles are about using Lego bricks to do something. And the central controls of this game are so smart. Your character, each of your characters, there's a red one and a blue one, and is a single one-by-one brick. So it's a single one-studded, everybody has seen them before, single brick, and it has a little eyeball on it. One's red, one's blue. Now, I'm not going to spoil anything that happens in this game, because the discovery of this game is part of the joy. But there's some evolution that happens. But I will say you start out as a one-by-one brick, the game uses physics. So you're just kind of flopping along. You're just kind of rolling around, and you move that character directly, but you're able to just kind of roll across the environment, jump, and by pressing the B button on the controller, when we're playing on Xbox controllers, you put pressing a button on the controller, you can attach yourself to a nearby stud. So the, you know, Lego studs are present on some of the exposed bricks, right? There's plates that don't have studs, and then there are the bricks that do have studs. And you are a one-by-one brick, so you can attach the bottom of yourself on a stud. And when you do, you can stay sort of locked to the stud line and move along it. But then you can jump off and roll again, and you're flopping and, you know, kind of not upright anymore. But you can lock to a stud. So part of the traversal is like leaping between studs. So you'll jump off one and then press the button to lock to a stud, and it'll just sort of suck to the stud. And it's very satisfying, that process of sort of attaching yourself to the studs in the environment. But if you attach yourself to a stud of a loose brick, you can roll with it still attached to you. And you can attach multiple bricks onto yourself and keep rolling so long as you can maintain momentum, because the physics are such that the more bricks you add, the heavier you are, the more difficult that is. So you can use your own body to sort of Katamari Damacy style move things through the environment, move something over here and then attach that. And so you can build things, build little bridges for yourself, little platforms to get to a higher area. And so you're constantly kind of manipulating the environment, but there's also switches and levers and things that move. And dude, there's a boat. It gets so brilliant and just so clever the way it leverages Lego and asks you to think in ways of how I actually find fun with physical Lego bricks. Like, that is why I call it the most Lego game, because what I'm actually doing feels to me like the kind of play I enjoy most when I'm playing with physical Lego. And the game is gorgeous. I love the look. It's, if you saw Builder's Journey, it's that same, you know, very highly realistic looking, you know, glossy Lego bricks.
And does it have ray tracing in it? I think, yeah. Builder's Journey, I think they added, or maybe it came with, but I love, like, it, the lighting in it is exquisite. That's awesome.
The water in this game is gorgeous. It's not Lego water, it's actual water, but it's all, you know, the physics simulation is really high caliber, I think. And just the number of times that I've turned to my son and we've high-fived about something that we did in cooperation with each other, some little puzzle we figured out, it has got that Portal thing where you, because of the highly modular nature of Lego, you can solve a puzzle and think, oh my gosh, the developers didn't intend me to do it that way, even though they probably did, you know?
Now, I just want to hop in here really quick.
Sure, please.
You brought me in as a creature of context, right? Someone who just can add that little bit of extra history to really, you know, bring out the flavor of something. Karsten Lund has been directing games for a very long time. A lot of Lego games, and made one of, I think, the like sweetest, most delicate and beautiful early co-op games of this kind of modern era in 2010. Do you know what Karsten's, like, I think, first directing gig was?
You're gonna put me on the spot. I don't know.
Say it, you'll know, because it's just one of those games that gets you right in the feels. Kane and Lynch 2 Dog Days.
You know, that is one of the first of those co-op-y experiences. Yeah,
it made you feel things.
Yes,
mostly very dirty and filthy.
That's right.
But it makes me really happy, because Kane and Lynch 2 Dog Days, for people who do not know, basically what happened is Square Enix and IO Interactive were like, what if we just completely ripped off Heat and made the lead criminal and the really evil guy who gets, things happen. What if we made them a team and we just made an entire video game series about it without having to pay rights?
But neither of them can
redeem the characters, though.
Neither of them can operate an elevator independently. They have to team up.
True. You have to have somebody press the elevator button. And what's wild about Kane and Lynch Dog Days 2, and why you should check it out, and why you can see, even when somebody gets a project like Steven Spielberg with Duel, and yes, I'm making that comparison here with Karsten Lund, but when somebody is a real talent, you can see it even in a bad project. In Kane and Lynch Dog Days 2, despite being the early messy days of co-op, is an actual work of art. I mean this. I like really mean this. It is a game that is absolutely unapologetically putrid. It is anti-beauty. It is hard to even spend more than 5 minutes in. And it is so committed to its bit of being a game about bad people in an era of surveillance that they went and made art. They went and made a 1970s movie. Wow. with a studio budget. So if you've also ever wondered why is this director not making more Kanan Lynch but is making Lego games, it's because turns out they didn't want to make more Kanan Lynch games after that. And this is a much better use of their talent.
Yeah, based on this, it's a win for everybody involved.
Yeah.
This is why I love having you on the show, Chris. This is why everybody should listen to your show, because that is awesome commentary. Anyway, so just to wrap up on Voyagers, we're not finished. I would say we're maybe halfway through the game. The way it reveals itself, the things that you are doing, the game starts and you're these little guys that live on this island with two little houses, and you go to sleep in your houses and you wake up in the morning and you're just kind of living your life. But off in the distance, there's a spaceship that takes off and then crashes, and you're like, oh, wow, that looks interesting. And it's all about curiosity and figuring out what's going on with that. And like I said, I'm not going to spoil anything, but it goes places, and it's really, really cool, in my opinion. That feeling of wow, we're doing this now. It's a home run, and the game is so beautiful. There's seasons, and the way they convey seasons with the Lego bricks is exquisite. I mean, if you love Lego as much as I do, and you have someone to play this co-op game with. I love co-op games like this. I love the experience of solving puzzles together and feeling like each of us is absolutely necessary. This is a home run. Home run. It's called Lego Voyagers. All right. That's going to do it for this episode of DLC. We do have parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those. But Chris Plant, always such a delight to talk to you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a real treat.
Tell folks so they can keep up with you and all the cool stuff you do online.
Oh, where can you do that? Well, number one right now is Post Games, my new show. If you want just a deep dive interview and essays and everything else, full on audio magazine each week on various topics, it's a great place to catch it. This week, I actually spoke with Shannon Loftus, who is the former VP of Xbox Game Studios. She started as an admin assistant in 1993 at Microsoft and climbed her way to the very top, wow. Which, let me tell you, as a woman in tech in the 90s and early 2000s, kind of a nightmare, which is a thing that we get into. But each week, the topics are a whole wide range of varieties. We talked with Dunkey. We've talked with the CEO of Atari. It's a blast. The other stuff you should check out, Besties and Resties, just like the oldest video game podcasts that aren't named any of the things that you all have made. It's nice to be alongside people where it's like, oh yeah, you've been through the real shit with this. And then I am on the board of a small indie theater in Santa Ana, California. If you live in SoCal, come to the Frida Cinema. But if you live anywhere else, go to your local indie cinema. Like, magic is happening in these spaces right now. There is a real boom of community. And right now it can feel like you don't have a community. And a lot of what I think is wrong with the world is trying to give you despair and take away hope that there are other people out there like you and that we can all be part of something together. And a great place to feel that without a lot of intimidation is an independent movie theater, because you can be in a dark room and just being in the same space as like-minded people is a really powerful thing. And who knows, maybe you end up chatting with them afterwards.
Lovely. Well said. Beautiful, beautiful notion. Christian Spicer, what about you? What do you got going on this week?
Well, like you mentioned, we put out our bonus content to patrons. It went out Friday morning. Folks can look for that there. That was a nice lift. I appreciate you coming along for that. And then you mentioned feeling this. Alex Solman has launched his own show, Dev to Dev, which I mentioned before. But we are really kicking up the gears on the next season of Feeling This Now. We've gone back and forth on topics. We had a great spreadsheet going. We're working on dates to get started. So patrons can look forward to the next season of Feeling This coming together. And I think we're going to make a couple of tweaks to the formula. You know, we're gonna take what worked and hopefully add to it. We're gonna Lucid Celeste is what we're gonna do. Gonna add a map and some combat. So I think folks will dig it. So look forward to that.
That's exciting. Very, very cool. You can follow me and the show on Blue Sky. We are Hype Train DLC on Blue
DLC
Sky.
DLC Hype Train. DLC
I always get it wrong.
One of these days.
The worst. And I'm Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. Also, you can listen to me talk about movies and TV shows on the Filmcast and science on a comedy show we call We Have Concerns. All right, let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts.
Hey, give us a suggestion.
Chris, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
Oh, I guess I probably should have saved that whole Mindy movie theater thing for this part,
perfect,
right,
yeah.
Man?
Well, we can use that.
I mean, I'm just going outside and taking a nice walk is a hell of a thing.
Yeah.
I'm sure people recommend it all the time, but man, is there anything better than a walk? Like, they never did end up inventing anything better than just like taking a walk. It's incredible. You can listen to this show while you're doing it. It makes you feel better. It releases all these like magical chemicals. I mean, like, don't get me wrong. There were parts of my life where I was like, yeah, drugs are pretty interesting and I love caffeine, but like a walk is an incredible thing. So that's my gift to the world.
Wonderful. I love it. Christian Spicer, what's your parting gift?
Well, speaking of the Get Up Kids, a band I adore, something to write home about, maybe my favorite album of all time. Like maybe,
hell yeah, sick.
Maybe not my most played, but I think maybe my favorite album of all time. A band, Trash, but it's T-R-S-H, no A, T-R-S-H. They had a new album come out today called String. Oh, today we're recording Friday. Come out this Friday called String Theory, and they are, Chris, that Midwest emo, and so there's like a little bit. They're a little screamo-ier more than sick. The Get Up Kids, but they're also like, what if modern baseball continued to evolve? So like, it's got a lot of kind of like Get Up Kid riffs, but then also like the modern baseball, not finger picking, but kind of like, you know, kind of like guitar.
I'm into it.
It's great.
They have the word Midwest in their X handle, which I mean, that tells me everything I need right there.
It's very much, you know, modern baseball, a little bit of Get Up Kids, and then a teeny bit of maybe like Finch or Thursday on a few of the songs, and they go a little harder. Absolutely fantastic. Their new album's great. It's called String Theory, and I believe they're on tour right now. I know they're supporting a couple of folks, but I think they're also playing a couple of smaller venues as a headlining act. So you can check them out with all the youths and pretend like you were you know, you were young again. T-R-S-H, album called String Theory.
My parting gift is a animated TV show on Netflix called Long Story Short. This is from the creator of BoJack Horseman, which is among my favorite things ever. And Long Story Short is a worthy successor. Very different show, still animated, much more grounded, doesn't have anthropomorphized animals. It's real humans. But it is about this Jewish family throughout the years. And each episode dips into different time periods of their life, different moments over many decades. And so it sort of leverages animation to be able to talk about the same characters at wildly different ages without having to cast different actors. You know, you don't have to worry about that live action believability of this being the same person over time because it's all cartoon. But it is hilarious. It is beautiful. It is poignant. It's a little depressing at times, a little, heavy at times, but well worth the watch. I thoroughly enjoyed Long Story Short on Netflix. We got a listener suggested parting gift. This was sent to us at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. It comes from Danny, who says, I've been meaning to send this parting gift idea for a while, but kept forgetting. There's a band called The Paradox that has been all over my algorithms lately. And if Christian hasn't already come across them, it feels like something that would fit his musical tastes. I first came across them when their song Do Me Like That was going viral on Blue Sky and TikTok. And they've since put out another song and I believe have an EP coming out this year. So that is the band called The Paradox, suggested by Danny. We appreciate it, Danny. Thanks for sending that in. If you'd like to have your parting gift read on the show, send it to us, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Chris Plant and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those fun bumpers. Our theme song was composed by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. If you'd like merchandise with our logo on it, we sell that over at our store, which is store.dlcpod.com. Of course, our biggest thanks are always reserved for our patrons who make this show possible. Without them, we would not be here. If you find value in what we're doing and would like to give some value back in return, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/dlcpod. All right, we'll see you next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.